We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from five-star app Meditation Studio and Muse, the personal meditation assistant that helps you learn to meditate. I'm Patricia Karpis, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation and mindfulness practices have the power to change our lives. To get started meditating on your own, you can download the Meditation Studio app in the App Store, where you'll get over 500 original and exclusive meditations by leading experts on everything from sleep, stress, and anxiety to happiness, leadership, relationships, and much, much more. It's like having a little inspirational coach in your pocket when you're facing any challenge. Any comments, reach out to us at untangle@meditationstudioapp.com. Today's guest is Amy Blankson. Amy's the co-founder of the global positive psychology consulting firm Good Think and the author of the book The Future of Happiness, Five Modern Strategies for Balancing Productivity and Well-being in the Digital Era. Her strategies focus on how we stay grounded so that we can channel our energy with intention, how to know ourselves better, which includes knowing our values and how we can remember these with every choice that we make, and training our brains to keep a more optimistic mindset, and how we can actually create a habitat for happiness. Amy shares so many great insights in this interview on all the many positive ways we can use technology to actually improve our levels of happiness. But there are many, many challenges too. Like the one statistic she shared that the average millennial uses their phone, for example, an average of 9 hours a day. Kind of shocking. Now, here's Amy to share her great wisdom and expertise on this important topic that influences us all. Amy, it's great to have you on Untangle today. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so excited to be here with you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I loved your book. And I think we're all so curious about the balance between technology and productivity and our well-being and happiness. And in your book, you talk about how we have more technology now than we've ever had before. But it's also at the same time that our levels of depression are up and rates of suicide are up and we're not necessarily happier. And so I just want to start by having you talk to us a little about some of the strategies you think about when you think about how we can thrive and be happier in this age of so much technology.
Well, that's a big question.
It's a big question, yes.
We certainly have felt more overwhelmed and fragmented than ever before in the last few years. When I'm speaking to audiences all over the world, this idea of feeling distracted is universal. And the question on everyone's mind is, how can you find happiness in the midst of all this distraction? And I think it's interesting if we look back at why we have all this technology, it really was to help us be more productive so that then we could do all of these other things that we really wanted to be doing, whether it's spending time with family or doing creative projects or being more mindful about other aspects of our lives. And we bought into this idea that if we just use technology, then that would magically happen. And what we're learning now is that there's actually a difference between using technology and using technology well, and that there is a chasm between the two, that we have to think about what the difference is, thinking really strongly about when and where, why, how we're using technology so that we can be mindful in the process. And in my book, I outline 5 strategies that help individuals and employees really move towards that direction of being a more mindful individual. So the first one being stay grounded. How do you stay grounded? You start with intention. You start about thinking about your values and who you are as an individual, because all of us use technology so differently, right? You might use technology for productivity and I might use it as entertainment. Both of which are totally fine, but the value systems and when and where and why and how we're choosing to use technology might differ because of that. And I have to know, who am I and how do I want to use it so that I can do the best job of doing that?
I love the first part is really knowing yourself and staying grounded. And I know there are some other strategies that you recommend, and I want to talk about those. But you mentioned in the beginning, we created technology for productivity. That's true. And that the more productive we are, the idea is that the more time we have to spend doing the things that we love with our loved ones. But I wonder if that's really happening, or if the more productive we are, do we get into this cycle of doing more, doing more, doing more? Number one. And number two, when did it shift from technology for productivity to technology for entertainment? And is that really the piece of it that snags our distraction?
I can give you a perfect example of how we think technology is going to benefit us, and then it turns out to be technology creates more need for technology. So I read a study recently that the average employee, actually, for every email that they send, they get 4 emails in return, which means that if you are the individual who thinks, I'm just going to send this one email on a Sunday night so that I can start my Monday morning fresh, what you've just done is quadruple the number of messages that are going to greet you on Monday morning, right? It's sort of like the Walking Dead coming back to chase after you. We can't get ahead of our email because it's a treadmill that never stops. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't use email. It just means that our expectations about what's going to happen are a little bit off. We find the same thing with positive psychology, which is how I got my roots in this field. When we think about what's going to make us happy, we look ahead and say, oh, if I could just finish this project, then I'll be happy. If I can go on vacation, then I'll be happy. If I can just get my degree and get a job, then I'll be happy. And what we learn from positive psychology is that that formula is scientifically broken. It turns out that individuals who pursue happiness first and foremost are significantly more likely to be successful later on. The formula is actually backwards. It's happiness leads to success, not success leading to happiness. And I bring that up because I think we do the same thing with technology. We think, if I can just get my inbox to 0, or if I can just respond to all my voicemails, then I'll be happy. And we now know that that formula doesn't work. We have to figure out, how can I make choices for my happiness right now in the present so that I can do all these other tasks that will still be there when I get done at the end of the day?
But how did technology become such a big player in our happiness? Is it that formula that technology causes us to be more distracted and distraction causes us to be less happy? Or like, how does this all fit together in the way that you think about it?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define technology. I think about technology just being a tool, right? And if you think about it being a tool, the concept of using a tool for greater happiness goes way back to the caveman days, right? Where you've got a caveman who suddenly discovers the round wheel and he thinks, oh my goodness, now I can roll things around and not have to carry these heavy stones everywhere.
Right.
As we move forward in society, we see evidence of other types of technology that we did the same thing with, whether it's the newspaper or the radio or the television, the Nintendo. And now we have the internet and the Internet of Things and VR and AR and AI and you name it. And as we're looking at these types of technology, are they a tool or are they supposed to be the savior that's going to make everything better? I think they're just a tool. And knowing that, and knowing that we have this history of trying to use them to get to happiness, I think we have to step back and say, what void are we trying to fill to shove technology into that hole? What is it? Is it a need to be needed? Is it a need to be productive? Is it a need to feel like you're contributing to the greater good? Whatever is that temptation, how we're using that tool needs to align with our desires, or there's a misalignment that we feel very viscerally.
I think that line that you just said, what hole are we trying to fill, really sort of resonates with me, because I think today about teenagers, and we all talk about teenagers and the way that they're so distracted by technology. And then you go back to like middle school kids and now young kids that have an iPad by the time they're 3. And instead of technology filling a hole, is it starting to lead us into certain behaviors that are either positive or negative? I think in some generations, like we can look at millennials and above and say, what hole are they filling? But then as we go back and look at young kids who are starting with technology, so primary to their brain function and their lives, is this going to have a different impact than filling a hole?
It's an interesting question you bring up. And certainly I hear this question about where are we heading in the future with our teenagers? A lot of parents will say, is technology destroying the social fabric of connection, that our young people won't know how to talk face to face anymore, that they won't know how to interview for a job because they've never talked to another human being? Some of these fears, I think, are maybe a bit unrealistic, but they do trend with this idea of, is the younger generation facing a future in which they no longer have a sense of boundaries about what is healthy and not healthy? And certainly the average millennial today uses their phone a shocking 9 hours per day. Not consistently, but overall, that's the average 9 hours per day.
Wait, that's millennials?
That's millennials, yes.
Wow.
And granted, they're using it for entertainment, for connection time, for school. So that number encompasses quite a bit of screen time. However, what I find really interesting is that 77% of parents feel like their teens are overly dependent on their devices. But the irony is that 41% of teens feel that their parents are too addicted to their devices.
A word from our sponsor, Happy Mammoth. This is the company that created the amazing supplement, Hormone Harmony, and they are dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients like herbal extracts called adaptogens that help the body adapt to any stressors, especially those chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. They're offering our listeners 15% off the first order at happymammoth.com using the promo code UNTANGLE. So if you're tired of hot flashes, night sweats, low moods, poor sleep, you get the drill. The things that put your life on hold, you will want to check them out. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com with the code UNTANGLE at checkout. That's happymammoth.com with the code UNTANGLE. Now on to Untangle.
So as we're looking at what's going on with young people, I think it's important to stop and look in the mirror at ourselves as well and say, wow, what am I doing with my behavior?
Yeah.
Have we all bought into this? Or is there something unique about the young people? And I actually think that we are in this grand or not so grand experiment for the last 10 years, 11 years since the iPhone came out, where when the phone first came out, we were completely enamored. I remember standing in line on my anniversary to get the first iPhone, and my daughter was 2 months old at that point. So I kind of liken her birth to being the birth of the iPhone. And by the time she was 1 year old, I was so proud that she already knew how to unlock a phone. I thought I was raising a genius. And now I realize that I was doing her a great disservice because I was introducing her to this technology way too early for something that she was cognitively ready for. But I think it was emblematic of what was going on as a society that we all thought this was a great new leap forward in technology, and it was, but we had no boundaries about what we were doing with that technology or even what the dangers were. And we now know today that even the average smartphone user, this is not millennials, this is just the average smartphone user, checks their phone 150 times a day, which means that if you open, close your phone and check something, and it takes you about 1 minute, that's 2.5 hours of your day checking your phone, which is a habit that we never had 11 years ago, right? We have a 2.5 hour new habit in our lives, just the equivalent of 38 days a year. And when I think about, right, it is shocking. When I think about when I say, oh, I wish I had time for training for a marathon or writing a book or learning a new language, all of a sudden I'm looking at my day and I say, wow, I have 2.5 hours that I could do something with. Is the choice I'm making really what I want to be doing? Or am I making an unintentional choice that is sucking my time away from what I really, really want to be doing? And that's the point that I want to call everyone to the mat to think about. What are your current technology habits? Do you even know? And if you don't know, how can you find out? And then how do we go about aligning what we want to be doing with what our actual behavior is? We call that the no-do gap. It's what we know we're supposed to do, but then we don't actually do it.
But how do we decide what's good or bad? So when you say, what are your tech habits? So like, I want to go back to the teenagers for a second, where you said 77% of parents feel their teens are overly dependent on their devices. What I'm curious about has that created a generation of kids who prefer technology communication over human communication? And you mentioned being cognitively ready. When are we cognitively ready to use our tech more habitually? And then I want to go back to the question of what are your tech habits? Because I don't really know how we define what's good or bad for us. And maybe that goes back to your values and how we stay grounded. But I kind of want to understand that a little bit more.
Yeah. So I want to actually answer your question in reverse, because I think it's fascinating. The question of how much is too good or what's bad. I like the quote by William Shakespeare that said, there's nothing good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. And it really says to me that it is not a screen or a piece of glass that's necessarily good or bad. It's how we're using it. It's what we're using it for. And one of my favorite research studies by Dr. Richard Kraut of Carnegie Mellon came out in 1998. And it was a study done where they had a group of young people on the internet for 5 hours. And before and after this experiment, they checked or they measured their levels of happiness, their productivity, their optimism levels, and everything you would expect from the study came true. After 5 hours, the young people were less connected, less focused, less productive, less optimistic. And so that's what we hear in the media quite often. What we don't hear is this study that he repeated 4 years later when social media networks were better developed. And he repeated the exact same experiment, except this time he included a new experimental group where he specifically had the young people on the internet with people that they would consider strong ties. So they had two or more connections to. So they knew somebody online and offline, or they knew someone on Facebook and by phone, or they connected by YouTube and Twitter, whatever it might be, two or more connections. And what they found was that the individuals who had more connections with the individual they are interacting with, actually at the end of 5 hours, were more connected, more focused, more productive, more optimistic about society, which says that it's not necessarily the 5 hours that's the problem. It's how we're spending the 5 hours. And so when we're thinking about whether or not millennials, that they have this new mode of communication, I'm not so much worried about having another layer of communication. I'm worried if they're completely swapping out one communication style for another. So if they're only talking to friends online, it's problematic. But if they're talking online and in real life, or online and offline and on Facebook, that's even better, because it means that their depth of connection is actually more intensive than it was back in the day when we would just call our friends whenever we got access to a phone, which was maybe once in a blue moon. So I think if we're really realistic about what's happening there, it shifts the conversation just a little bit and gives me a little bit more hope, to be honest, that our young people are more savvy than we even thought, and that they might actually be better communicators than we ever were.
That kind of makes sense for millennials because they started a little bit later. Do you worry about teenagers who started with technology at a much younger age, that they might not have the same boundaries? Or how do we develop these boundaries?
I'm actually a mother of three daughters. So I have an 11-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 6-year-old. So I'm living this as we speak.
Oh my gosh, but they're not teenagers yet.
They're not teenagers. And to be honest, I think that millennials and that X generation have a lot harder time with the digital era evolution than the younger generation. Specifically, the younger the children are today, I think that it is becoming easier and easier to build digital boundaries into our communities. And what I mean by that is, I mentioned earlier that my 11-year-old was on the iPhone from early in her life all the way through now, and she's 11. And I find that she struggles the most with boundaries over my 6-year-old. My 6-year-old will be on her phone, and at a certain time, she'll pass it off to me and say, "Mommy, my screen time is over. Here's the phone." Something my 11-year-old would never do, right?
Right.
But I think the difference there is that because we realize the need for boundaries, all of a sudden, we are using language as a society. Things like the word digital boundaries even exist, right?
Screen time exist.
We know the importance of talking about digital citizenship or safety online. And so the younger and younger generations are getting this kind of language coming out of schools, out of community organizations, and hopefully out of home as well. And my goal and my mission is to continue to elevate that conversation. Part of the way that parents can create digital boundaries is, number one, having some sort of home router system so that they can really monitor what's going on with their child's phone use or Wi-Fi use. I use the Disney Circle because it not only enables me to monitor my children's screen time and see what they're doing online, but I also am able to see when other people, other friends come into the household and want to use my Wi-Fi network, that they are not introducing content that I wouldn't have approved for my own kids without me knowing. So a lot the routers out there don't actually monitor other people coming into the house. They're hard-coded onto devices. Another thing that I'm doing to create digital boundaries is that I talk about it constantly with my family, probably more so than most because my children know that I research this, but we have conversations constantly about, was that appropriate or inappropriate, or what would be another better way to handle this or to say that if your friend's on a group text and they're driving you nuts and you're trying to get your homework done, what are some ways that you can explain to your friends why you're not chiming in or why you're signing off? How do you use your out-of-office message, even as a child or as a teenager, when your friends are trying to get a hold of you and you want to get away from your devices for a little bit? Can you use an out-of-office message? These are strategies and techniques that I'm teaching my kids daily. The other boundary that I think is really important, I call these boundaries, but it's really development of a positive skill set for my kids that I'm teaching them offline that I believe directly translates to what they do online. And these are skills that come out of positive psychology. Things like, how do you use gratitudes in your life? Can you practice looking for the things you're grateful for in life? Can you practice journaling meaningful moments in your day? Can you do acts of kindness for other people? So at the end of every day, we'll ask our kids as they're going to bed, what are three things you're grateful for? And what's one selfless act that you did for somebody else? And it's not just training them as individuals, it's specifically also training them that when they go into an online world, those are the kind of things that they should be scanning for, the kind of people and friends they're looking for, and the kind of people they want to be, starting from a very early age. And I think if we just address the online behaviors without looking at the offline, we're missing a critical opportunity.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health, mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to untangle.
That makes so much sense. It's great advice for parents and for kids. And I love the way that you outline those digital boundaries and also how to build those skill sets in your children so that they become good human beings overall, and then they'll make healthier choices. Because you do talk a lot about being in a distracted mindset and making choices that may not be for the best reasons. So I think that's really cool. I think you talk about those micro decisions. There was a quote I pulled: micro decisions will either be the start of a slippery slope down a mountain or the choice that gives you a stable foothold to keep climbing up the mountain.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That was about the boundaries that you set and the choices, like really teaching how to make healthy choices.
And if I could add one thing to that too, Patricia,
yeah.
It's that not only am I teaching offline skills and I'm trying to set physical boundaries for digital connection, but I'm also modeling how to use technology well. One of the things that I like to do with my children, I love using a headband with my kids. We actually sit down and we will, for better or worse, have a competition over who can meditate and recover their mind the most number of times.
Oh my gosh.
Everything turns into a competition, right? But I am showing them how to meditate and that they can use technology to help them learn how to meditate. They can see progress and we can have fun in the process of that as well. So I wind up teaching them through apps that will specifically train them in some of these skill sets or help them sustain positive habits like habit trackers, like Habitify or the positive online platform Happify that reinforce some of these things that I'm trying to teach offline as well.
We're going to take a little break to give a shout out to our sponsor, Chosen Foods. We love this company because they make super healthy, mindful, nourishing foods. I'm personally in love with their 100% pure avocado oil and their pure oil sprays for cooking. Their sprays have just one ingredient, avocado oil. So good for you, and you can use it for anything. Head to chosenfoods.com/untangle and use promo code untangle50 during checkout to get your 50% discount off of your entire order. What a great company. Now back to our show.
I was going to ask you about that because you do mention some of the products and also the trends in technology that are supporting these positive behaviors. Can you talk about some of these that are your favorites?
Absolutely. So one of my absolute favorite wearables is the Spire Stone. It's a small lava-shaped rock that clips onto your bra strap or your waistband and measures your respiration rates. And by tracking your respiration, the app that connects to it will show whether you're currently in a calm state, in a state of focus, or a state of flow, whether you're feeling anxious. And if you start to feel anxious and your breath pattern speeds up too much, it'll vibrate gently and say, hey, why are you feeling anxious? Maybe take a second to breathe. And this one turned out to be one of my favorites because a few years ago, I wound up having my daughter in the backyard swimming and a little friend jumped onto her back just at the wrong angle and wound up breaking her neck.
Oh, I remember this in the book. That was horrifying.
Yes. It was horrifying as a parent.
Yes.
And fortunately, today she is just fine and kids heal up so well. But it was one of those freak accidents. I remember driving to the hospital to get x-rays for her. And I remember thinking, wearing the Spire Stone and it's not vibrating. I wonder why. And that thought quickly got dismissed as I was busy with what's going on in front of me. But it didn't go off until I was walking out of the hospital that day. And I remember seeing the Spire Stone vibrate and send a message to my phone saying, you're feeling stressed. And I was like, I know. And in that moment, it made me stop and think, why did it go off right then? And so I paused and thought about what I was doing in that moment. And I realized I had been looking around the hospital at all the other people and wondering what they were thinking about me as a mother. Was I abusive? Did I not take good care of her? Was I not watching what she was doing enough? And immediately my cortisol levels spiked through the roof and I became so self-conscious thinking about that. And so that had triggered the stress response that the spire caught. And in that moment, I was able to mindfully pivot to be more of who I wanted to be in that moment, the mother who was thinking about my daughter and what she needed and where she was going with life. And prior to that, I would have probably taken 3 weeks to get to that realization. But instead, in 30 seconds, I had been able to say, I'm stressed. I don't want to be stressed. I don't want to think about this. I want to be this person, and changed. And I was so grateful for that insight, because what's happening with some of these wearable devices is that for the first time in history, we're getting to be able to peel back the layers of our mind to understand some of those underpinnings of what's going on and how we respond to the world. And when we become more aware of them, we can become the person we want to be. So that was one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah, I love that you talked about that, because some of the things that you learn through that technology or what we learn in meditation, right? Like this ability to have a witness mind, this self-awareness, this increase in being able to understand what's going on in any moment, because you can return to your breath and not get swept away by any event that's happening. So it sounds like in a way, some of this technology is a little bit of a shortcut to helping you see what's going on in any given moment with more clarity.
It is. It's both a shortcut on the back end, but I also think that it's a wonderful preventative measure as well.
Yeah.
From years now, I've taken a multivitamin hoping that it would do something good for me.
Right.
I'm not sure what. I don't know what I was deficient in, but I just knew I was supposed to take one.
Right.
It was sort of this blind approach, but now we're getting this insight and information that says, oh, your iron is low, so take an iron supplement specifically. I think that that's where technology is heading, that we'll be able to say, you know what? Your breath patterns have been a little bit shallow. Why don't you preemptively take a moment to breathe so that when you get to this stressful project later in the day, you'll be ready to handle it. I think seeing that entire cycle is going to become part of our evolution of understanding behavior as a human being.
In that light, do you have a vision of this lovely balance between technology, productivity, and happiness and well-being? Do you sort of see how this all fits together in your vision of the future?
I think that the vision hangs around this idea of intention. When I'm thinking about what would a perfectly balanced person look like in the digital era, I thought about that for a long time, actually, as I was writing my book. And it turns out it's really hard to think about a role model. We have these people in our lives. We hear Steve Jobs didn't let his kids use his phone, and Arianna Huffington is a big proponent of sleep. And we've got Google telling us the importance of play while we're working. But somebody who's truly and fully balanced in the digital era is not someone that I think we have a good grasp on. Where I think it comes back to is an intentionality that, will we fall off balance daily? Yes. Will that continue to happen? Yes. But will we fall off in a spectacular fashion? Hopefully a little bit less, right? Will we be able to calibrate a little bit better as we get these insights into our behavior? I hope so. I think about Philippe Petit, who is the famous Wire actor, who they made the Wire movie after him a few years back. And he talks about how he strung a wire between the Twin Towers in New York City and wound up crossing across that wire hundreds of feet in the air with all these spectators and police officers actually waiting to arrest him because he did this without permission. And he wound up crossing the wire and nobody would come out to get him because they didn't want to fall, of course. And so he wound up enjoying himself as he found his balance on the wire. And he crossed not only once or twice, but six times, and then proceeded to lay down on the wire, hanging hundreds of feet in the air. And he said it was one of the most blissful experiences of his life because it was just him and the birds and the air, and he just relaxed into that moment. For me, that is a vision of where I want to get in the future, that I can walk across this quote-unquote wired world and find that sense of peacefulness in the midst of it, that when I feel like I'm going to fall, I know how to lean to the other side. And when I feel like I'm going down, I can pull myself back up. And that is going to be a constant exercise. It is not a static place that we get to, but a place that we create habits that lead us into that moment for hopefully a long time.
Yeah. And it sounds like the challenges that we'll have on that wire aren't all about technology. And you're talking really about tools for resilience that will help us kind of manage all of the challenges, big or small, that we'll face in our life. And I think that's such an awesome way to think about it. Before we close, because I don't think we got all of these in, your book is about the 5 strategies for thriving in the digital age. And you talked about the first one in the beginning of the interview, which was to stay grounded, start with your intention, your values, know who you are. And I guess that's also the second one, which is know thyself. And then the other 3 you talk about are training the brain, creating the right mindset, and being a conscious innovator. Can you just quickly go over those last 3?
Sure. So training the brain really comes back to that idea of using existing technology tools to support and to train your mind for better, more mindful use of technology in the future. So those are things like using the Muse or the Spirestone or Happify. These are specifically tools that we can use to elevate our mindset and to retrain the neural pathways in our brain for more optimal thought patterns. 4 is creating a habitat for happiness. And this idea is that our physical spaces actually impact our happiness levels, not so much in a direct correlation, but it's our perception of our habitat. So if our habitat, our world, whether it's the place we live in, work, play, learn in, if those places feel cluttered with too much technology, whether it's hardware or it's email or it's just stuff on your hard drive, we all know that your computer will come to a grinding halt if you have not enough memory, right? Our brains work much in the same way, that if we have too much that's all crowded in that space, we begin to slow down and become less productive. So that strategy is all about both physically removing the unnecessary digital clutter from our world, but also removing and creating spaces to make way for the future, knowing that we have this massive influx of technology constantly coming, that every holiday season that's coming up, we know that there's going to be an infinite number of new gadgets and devices that are must-haves for your world. And then, do you actually have space to bring them into your life? Particular strategy in the book is very hands-on, practical, detailed about how do you sort, how do you declutter, where do you take old devices, how do you make more space on your computer? I really tried to get granular because people want things that they can put into practice right away. And then the last strategy is a more elevated final strategy. It's focusing on how we can innovate more consciously. And this chapter, strategy, I really wanted to empower individuals to not wait for somebody else to come up with the latest, greatest new idea to solve the world's problems, but really, how can we collaboratively come together to begin to make a difference in the world? And as an example, I've recently joined the leadership team for a group called the Digital Wellness Warriors. It's a collective of more than 70 different organizations that are working within the digital well-being space to rethink how we can frame the conversation that's happening in society around what it means to be well with our technology. And the reason I think this is so important that we stop to innovate and to own that role of innovator is because I do believe that the media has trained us to feel like we are victims of what's happening with technology. The big developers, the Apples, Facebook, Googles of the world, have created such intense devices that they have addicted us against our will, and now our minds have been hijacked. And when I hear that language, I feel like a victim, right?
But right.
I think that we're more empowered and enlightened than that. I think that we have the capacity to hear that and say, but that's not where I want the end of the story to be. And here's what I'm going to do about it. And so I talk about the importance of upsourcing knowledge, collaborating together, and using specific brainstorming tactics to help create a process of innovation that is constant cycling through rethinking what's going on in our world, knowing that our world is changing every single day in front of us. How do we not just innovate once, but constantly innovate to be ahead of the curve so that we can have a future of greater happiness?
How did you decide to name your book The Future of Happiness? I think you might have just answered that question, but we've talked about so much, and so much of what you've presented in the book relates to these trends and these tools and breakthrough ideas for how we can build technology that matters and use technology in the best interest of ourselves. So I was just curious how you decided to name it The Future of Happiness.
I think it was a marriage of two of my favorite definitions coming out of the field of positive psychology, which is kind of a dorky answer, but it's the truth. The first one would be the definition of happiness, which I pull from the ancient Greeks, which is the joy that we feel striving after our potential. That's happiness, the joy we feel striving after our potential. The other definition being optimism, and that is the belief that our behavior matters. And when I think about my reason for existing in this world, of course, is to leave the world just a little better for future generations than it is for myself, like many of us. And so I want to do that using optimism to generate future happiness. So this seemed like one strategy that could help get people to move in that direction. I think there are many, many different ways that we can pursue a future of happiness, but the digital future seems to be an elephant in the room for our time. And I wanted to add some strategies to that that I thought would be very helpful.
I really appreciate you being here today. And I feel like I could ask you questions for another 5 hours. It's just, there's so much here. And I'm just so grateful that you were able to be with us today. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much to Amy for being with us today. You can find her book, The Future of Happiness, at all major booksellers. If you have a minute, would you give us a review or rating? It helps to get the word out. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at patricia@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to download Meditation Studio in the App Store. We'll see you next time.